This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Rathke. You're listening to Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Time in the United States, and time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town, so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 FM is located, or the east side of New Orleans, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org. A podcast will be available with the show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to our own program director, John Kane. What a great honor. John, you and me, we're on the air, Wade's World. And why are we talking? We're using two or three excuses to talk to John today. One of them is we're very close to something I'm going to announce towards the end, a Johnapalooza, which is February 1st. I'll give you more details, but what's happening February 1st, Brother John?
Actually, man, I'll have my 80th birthday.
80 years old. Old as dirt. And we love him every day. He's in here except Sunday. Not Sunday, but, you know, he keeps plowing away. And half the time, the reason we're on the air has to do with John Kerry. Let's start, though, when we talk about KABF and the long time you've been here. What was the radio scene like before 1984, when we first pushed the button and went on the air? Well, you were on a DJ here in this community. What was happening?
Well, when the KABF, before KABF came on the air, I mean, there was no place for people like us. We're not queers, freaks. It was mainstream, and marginalized people were not in mainstream media. And I think when you founded Acorn and found out what you had to do to be able to network is what made you and the organization realize we need our very own media, radio.
And but you were an overnight DJ, or you were on the air at the time, weren't you?
Yeah, I was on the air at the time, long before, probably. I was probably on the air 5 years before you founded Acorn, which was 1970, as I recall.
1970, June 18th was Acorn's birthday. So, what, 65 you're talking about?
66? Yeah, and about that time, as you were putting your board together with your constituency, people like Gloria Wilson and those people that I grew up with, I sort of became the network person that they reached out to. Although you and I had never officially met, but it was through them that I discovered the work of Acorn, which is something I wanted to see happen for a change. And I was a little bit ahead of the curve, because when I got into radio, I didn't go in as a DJ. I didn't want to be called a DJ, so I took a specific proposal to the manager of the first radio signal here in the city, which was 1250 AM. That was the first radio.
Back on the AM.
Yeah, and it was licensed through many different entities and people. And it's how I discovered the whole radio world and was able to enter it.
And what was your proposal there to 1250 AM?
I came to change the image of African Americans in radio, the buffoonery, the the nonsensical trash talk they call it now. It had no intellect to it. That's what I wanted to bring. So I discovered an opportunity. They needed an engineer and a host. They wanted to call a DJ overnight. I said, I'll be the engineer. I won't be the DJ. I'll be the host, because I'm going to bring you something different that you don't hear. Theater, off-Broadway theater, stuff that people could really be informed about and get involved in. And so that was my stick. So I did a five-hour show every night, six nights a week, midnight until 6 a.m.
Okay.
And I put everything that you did not hear in mainstream radio into that mix.
Look, you and I were talking about a story. Once you got a call from the king of pop, James Brown, called you at one point. He wasn't calling with a compliment, though,
not
was
a compliment.
He, John?
Now, about that time, James had four or five radio stations. He was well known by the time I hit the circuit and as the godfather of soul. And so he had several radio stations down here, AM, small, and one was in Knoxville. They had probably one in Tennessee, another one in close to Memphis, probably one in Mississippi. And so the way the AR people turned out the music was to get in touch with the program director who set the format. That's why it had such redundancy to it, because
right.
The host had no control over that. Well, I did have control over mine. That was what the agreement was.
And you're overnight. You were the man.
Yeah, and I wasn't playing top 40 music. So James Carl was, hey, brother, why aren't you playing my music? I said, man, my format is much different from top 40. So we had him booked into the show. Our show was a partner. Our radio station was a partner in bringing James Brown, and it was about three or four actually brought out to the Coliseum. I forget the date, but it seemed
to be. Well, I'll never forget seeing him in New Orleans Municipal Auditorium, 1966. Me and one buddy, we went in there. It was...
He's a cooking dude, right?
That was a wild show. That was one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life.
Yes, he could bring it. James Brown and the Famous Flames.
And the Famous Flames. The Flames were great, too.
Yeah.
But he had everybody going.
He had everybody going, but administrative-wise, to run a radio station, he just didn't have it.
Oh, sure. That's a whole different world.
He was working hard to get his product out there. So we had this little clash. I told him I'd be at to see you at the concert. So I brought my gang with me to the concert. Everything
he was going
to
whip your butt, wasn't he, Big John?
Nah.
not at home. It was all friendly.
Yeah.
Those were the days. So you were there virtually helping out. I mean, you may not have been on the staff, and you weren't program director almost from the first day. So I left here in 77, late 78, and we moved the national headquarters to New Orleans, where it was easier to do a lot of what we were doing. And we had an application, but it took a long time before we straightened out all the business, and with the FCC and UALR tried to jump on there a little bit, and we finally got on the air in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking, this would be the 33rd year.
The last day of the application, too, it was close. People don't realize it.
Well, look, there's some parts of our nervous system we can let go, but... and you were here right from the beginning. So what was it like on the first days when y'all pushed the button?
Well, to me, it was just order, getting things ordered. It was chaotic, obviously. Last day of the allocation, trying to get it on in 24 hours, running tests all day and night. So because we didn't have people that were committed fully to certain demographics in the jazz shows and the gospel shows, which were the drive time and the principal part of the day part programming early, I was there every day helping Tom with the testing stuff, mainly in the studio, just doing the things that he needed done.
That's Tom Rusk.
Tom Rusk.
Longtime engineer. He's been with us since the beginning.
Yeah, he got us on the air, man. It's an amazing story, man.
Yeah, and he's kept us on the air, so some props for Tom, yeah. But we'll get him on another day.
So it was pretty chaotic, and that's where I just... put my commitment on the board and just did shows that had some intellect to them, not your typical jock shows.
And it was shows that weren't in this community before that.
Yeah, it was not.
So how did people respond? Did they know the station was coming on? Was this a well-kept secret? Or there were, people jumping at 523 West 15th saying, what's going on here now?
Everybody's trying to get in there. It was amazing when they realized, oh, it's going on there, actually.
Because it was years in the making.
It was years in the making, and I think people didn't believe it was going to happen. And it was so close to the deadline, man, that... we weren't saying anything. We were just working hard.
Well, I guess so. So were we on 24 hours a day in the beginning, or
yes.
We started slower?
No, we were on 24 hours a day. As a matter of fact, we had mostly live hosts in the studio then.
Even overnight?
Because we could get people easily. The thing was to be sure it was consistent. That was kind of hard to make happen.
Well, that's a challenge we still face.
But with archives and stuff built that over time, we were able to stay on 24 hours a day without fail.
So were there any specific parts of the community that responded more enthusiastically than others, or?
Particularly African-Americans did, and the young people did, because they were eager to be stars, I guess, or whatever their aspirations were. A lot of them found out there was a process to get on, and that was the thing that sort of got us organized, the actual protocol and the procedure of getting on there. You got to do this.
Right.
You're accountable for these things and responsible. And
y'all had to do the training from scratch.
Everybody got that orientation. We had regular meetings for the host. I still like to use host instead of saying DJs because it's really not broad enough to clarify all the work we do.
I know we were also the first radio station here in this area to have Spanish language broadcasting. When did that start?
The Spanish language broadcast began about 22 years ago.
Willie
25
takes
now
a lot
because
of credit for that.
Yeah, because Willie Cosme, who was eventually became one of our station managers, one of those early broadcasters that came. Willie brought a lot of knowledge because he was on the front end of presenting the metrics to people that wanted to know how many Spanish were living where and working here and there. Willie had good track because he was working for the state. Educated himself. So,
right.
So we've had these people that had these skills and they saw the need and they just came, they stood up.
And Willie still helps us a lot, even though he's in Puerto Rico now. We don't really recognize that. We say he's still here in Little Rock, but he still cleans up all the shows, archives it. He did 1,200 hours almost we've got on the website for other stations to take advantage of. So, and that's been one of the amazing things is how long we've had some relationships with some of our, we'll call them hosts in your honor, John. Some people have been on the air a long time with us, haven't they?
A long time. And out of that initial, I think we started with about 25 shows. Now we're up to about 70. It's been a big change. A lot of people have been through here. So many, it would take me a few days to really try to determine who's where. And we've lost some great, had some great people here that, you know, did their work here. And they left this legacy here. They died actually working and volunteering for the station. So it speaks volumes about the value of this volunteerism and what it actually can do.
That's one of the things I think that a lot of people don't realize is even though it cost us more than $100,000 a year to stay on the air, that doesn't count the fact that we wouldn't be on the air at all without volunteers. We have one sort of semi-full-time person. You've been program director for years, but the last couple of years you've been essentially a volunteer, as have so many other people. But we've had people who have been on gospel shows for more than 10 years, who've been on... How long has Griff been doing his jazz show?
32 years.
We got Willie was saying the other night he's been on 22 years.
25 or so, yeah.
And then we have a lot of new shows just started that have built a base. Suge Radio, we've got the Nevermind folks who were just on and throughout the week, and our new partners with nonprofit community and CAL. So it's also an evolutionary kind of thing, isn't it, John?
Yes, it is.
So what have been some of your favorite shows over the years? I know you've talked about some names of some shows that perked my interest.
One of my favorite shows was Radio Reads. It's about education, obviously, and it was focused on kids. And kids are amazing, man, when you actually can revisit your, say, school days and stuff like that, and I saw that happen, was a part of that. We had a teacher that retired from teaching and found funding through the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps actually helped us do this for 7 years. Radio Reads is my favorite show of all because it had the aspect of learning how to read, but it was storytelling that got it. Got people involved in it. Got me involved in it. That's how I grew up on the radio, because No pictures. You got a person telling a story in your imagination.
Hooks there you go.
And that's how it worked. Yeah.
Now, one of the ways the community really rallied around us a little bit is when the tower was burned out up on Chenal Mountain. When was that?
That was September 19th, 1999, about 1 o'clock.
So almost 15 years after we went on the air.
Yeah, we were down 77 days. Some people thought we weren't going to get back. I had doubts, too, for a minute. Now, I think you probably did, too, just looking
at it. Yeah, no, that was a rough time.
What you had to do.
And why did they ever find out who did that or why? I know there's a lot of thoughts about it.
No, that was after the insurance settled out on what they assumed and analyzed as the cause of the fire. They didn't report it. They just sent us a bunch of pictures and says, here's the damage.
Yeah.
So we looked at a destroyed transmitter and the building, the whole site. We were off the air. And it was never really pursued. I just think it was hunters, that the place was never really secure. And for years until they got the TV farm.
Because we were the first
secure.
People up on the mountain. Now first it's the tower farm.
Tower farm.
We were the first tower up there, weren't we?
Yeah. And
used to be way out of town. Now there's you look out from our tower, there's all these $350,000, $400,000 houses on Chenal.
Yeah. And it used to be a real chore to get up there. You just didn't walk up there.
that's right. Before they put the roads and everything. But so, a lot of people believed it was also a retaliation for some of the programming we were doing.
I think that's what I really think it was, because about that time that it happened, we had the Queer Frontier on the air, probably one of the first gay and lesbian shows in the country, broadcast regularly. So they had a regular broadcast day or show every week. I think that was stuff that kind of start the ball rolling toward. We need to move.
There was some graffiti, as I've heard, on the walls of the tower building when it burned, and some stuff on the door. But the important thing is we did get back on the air in 77 days, and a lot of people in the community rallied around to support us, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And you know, being a worldwide organizer, weight in labor, I think that was the real catalyst of this, of the thing that brought us together, the people that could do the work, that showed people that was a real concern about value, about something like this. It needed to be on the air.
That's
just kept rolling.
Right. But you've seen a lot of people come and go here, and right now we're in a particularly interesting time for the station, because I know I've listened to a lot of our hosts talking recently. We're about to have a lot of changes in the future, and some people are really afraid about this, aren't they?
They
and
really
they're starting
are
to respond
afraid.
In the way that people call in. I know Tony got a lot of call-ins on his show the other day, and some other people. This new opening age of Trump has got a lot of the community sort of unsettled, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I see activists coming to the fore. I see them just reorganizing. We can't let the world go to hell in a handbasket if that's how people feel about it. I'm not that disturbed about it. I do know what I have to do, help keep something like this on the air so we can connect with people with concerns like that and show that there is a metric out there.
Well, part of the reason we've always called this the voice of the people is that this is the voice of the people.
Yeah.
So to the degree people are concerned and worried, this is where it's natural for them to come and for them to be heard. And no matter what the efforts are to silence people, 100,000 watts is a very powerful megaphone to make sure that people's needs are met and their aspirations are heeded. And that's one of the things that we're stewards of at this point. I mean, it's a very powerful instrument.
So going from here to there, as you often say, I see our program hosts becoming more concerned about what could happen, and I see probably a change in their presentation of these programs, more issues around actions.
Mm-hmm.
I see it coming.
Well, certainly, the nice thing about having a tool, which is what the radio station is, this will be interesting to see how people put that in their hands and use it, whether it's a shield or a hammer, we'll have to see.
But we got a good thing already breaking out, and that's the new Speak Up Arkansas format. And
it's a very encouraging show, 5 o'clock to 6 on Wednesdays, a nonprofit community, and we've got a lot of credit to give Paul Kelly, who's been on our board for years as well, and he's sort of shepherded or produced or whatever we want to call that show. But I got here in time Wednesday afternoon to hear him, and there was he must have had 7 or 8 people on the air talking about pushouts, discriminatory suspensions of young, largely African Americans in schools. Those are kind of issues people need to hear about. He's going to be talking about, you know, the criminal justice system and some of the stuff next week. And I think we're going to have 52 weeks a year of some very interesting programming. And CALS obviously follows that, which is another huge partner and resource for us. So we're very excited about some of where we're going in the future. And partly because, you know, for all the heroic work that John Kane, as program director, and our volunteers have done, we need, you know, we need partners, because we still have to, 100,000 watts sucks up a lot of juice on that tower. Yes, we got to pay that electric bill. We've got to keep the doors open and make sure the equipment doesn't break too often.
And that's actual part of the expense. We spend about $7,000 a month.
Is what now?
In actual expense. You know, the
power there's a
bill.
Hard nut.
Yeah.
There's nothing left over. But I think that's why we've continued. When's the first time we did a pledge drive? It was right at the beginning, I know.
Right at the beginning. As a matter of fact, people were door knocking on the Buy a Watt campaign, which people might think just started the last couple of years. But that's
Tampa and Little Rock. We started with Canvas programs.
Yes.
Going out in the community saying, hey, we're going to have a station. We may have to go back to that.
Yep.
Go out and do some door knocking. But the Buy a Watt came early, and we still we have a pledge drive.
Every quarter.
Every quarter. We've got one coming up February 4th.
February 4th. First one for the new year, 2017.
And we're actually going to launch that sort of at the Johnapalooza. We've got a Whitewater, I think, is I sent a text. I don't know if it's 100%, but I think it's 100% set for Wednesday evening, February 1st, which is the John Kane birthday. We're going to have a Johnapalooza birthday party and give him some... I just got the note. I mean, you know, we're just like, you know, we are just a professional operation. I didn't bring my phone in, so I didn't have people interrupting, but I knew I was going to get a text from our assistant station manager, Brian, saying, yeah, it's set. We're going for February 1st. We want all the friends of KBF, and not only the friends of KBF, but people who've listened to John and John's show and know the work he's done. Come by, get a picture with Big John. You know, he's not going to be 80 every day, you know, and we're going to do a special thing on the pledge. You're going to get a T-shirt if you give any contribution over $80, which is his birthday, or up to 100, because we're shooting for John to get to 100. I may have to come pick him up when I'm in town and bring him down to the station when he gets to be in the upper 90s, but because the stairway's rough here. Yeah. But John's been the guy. And I think we're going to have an exciting pledge drive. I'm hoping that people can use this pledge drive and the Johnapalooza. It's important to realize what a huge resource in the time of Trump that this station is going to be. I know the community has really been stepping up for a lot of nonprofits here since the election, and it's not that we're anti-Trump or pro-Trump or whatever, but people are concerned. There are threats to immigrants, a threat to religions, and a threat to really the American way of life in terms of some of what we're seeing from, you know, encouragement perhaps from the president-elect and from some of the supporters that are rallying here. And so there needs to be an objective voice. There needs to be a forum where people can come. And, John, you're going to be making sure that happens.
Yeah. Actually, Pledge Drive will start on my birthday. That's what we actually
Yeah, we're going to get this thing going.
We're going to roll this baby out, do some good work.
And, that's exactly right. So you're still a music man, I know, and part of what you're still doing is supporting the jazz programming, because that's been a lot of what your personal interest has been. But you were lobbying me pretty hard since I've been up here about country music. Well, what's John Cain country music man about?
The tradition is coming back. They got some young people here that are going back to the traditional sound of country, not that Nashville doesn't work anymore like it did before, but
less pickups and beach bunnies and more twang and guitar picking, or what are you talking about?
It could be all of that. You know, most of the country places, there's not a country music venue in the city, for instance. Most of them are in outlying areas, Duval's Bluff, Leslie, you know, those kind of areas.
All within
our broadcast range, and we got a good team working on developing a way to do that with local artists and the venues. So pretty soon, man, we were going to be having some real good live country music venues in the traditional style. We got some great musicians around here, Wade, of all genres. And so,
I think that's one of the things that's been interesting about how our volunteer DJs have developed too. Deb does the big blues thing the last couple of years, that festival, which has become very popular. You know, we've done things in Lake Village. I know Griff and you put together a big program down there that included gospel music and every other kind of thing. Obviously, you're talking about trying to make some stuff happen with country up in Leslie and Duval's Bluff and places like that. But this is it's an incubator, isn't it? Not only for the voice of the people, but for the music of the people.
Yeah. And you know, they've made a lot of claims about Arkansas being, you know, at the bottom of all kinds of different kinds of lists. The most important thing culturally, Wade, is that Arkansas is what it is, and it is a principal a partner in the development of jazz worldwide. That's fact. That's not fake news.
that's a fact,
man. And so just looking at that aspect of that and all the things associated with it, it's an incubator, just like you said.
That's exactly right.
And you got people now got a good opportunity to come forth, stand up, and do the right cultural thing. And I think that'll make an impact on the new administration and anything else in the world.
Well, and the cultural aspect and the music is part of what makes the life living, and the work is hard enough. And as much as, for example, I spend on, you know, trying to build people's organizations and the political side of it. You know, you've got to have the heart with the hope.
Yes.
We've been talking to John Cain, who's the program director at KBF and has been helping out on this station for all 34 years. I want to, John and I have mentioned that we're going to have a Johnapalooza, I've been calling it. I'm sure it'll have some fancier name, a birthday party. But
Brian, I figured it out, huh?
We'll come up with something, but maybe we'll stick with Johnapalooza. I don't know.
That's cool.
Yeah, 80 to 100, but that's going to be at Whitewater. Everybody knows where Whitewater is, anywhere in our broadcast area, and they've been good friends and partners of ours, and that's going to be February 1st. Not Valentine's Day, but we want you to come show some love. Be there for KBF. Whitewater's obviously giving us the gate, and John's going to be there. We're going to have some promotions. Yeah. We're going to really start this pledge drive with a boost. We go 2 weeks every year. It's officially start on the 4th of February. You'll hear all the DJs talking about it. But this time we're going to do something special to you know, commemorate John's time, 80 years old, and the fact that are moving another milestone, but also to make sure that we get our listening community to rally with KBF about how we can use this station and the power of this megaphone and this 100,000 watts to give people the information they're going to need to not only survive but to thrive during this time. That's what's important, and that's why we want to make sure we're there with our community and with our audience and all of our partners. So be there. John will take a picture with you. If you donate $80 or anything over $80 to the station, we're going to have a T-shirt for you. If you do anything that says That's over $28, which is the amount of time John's been on the staff, or 34, in which he's been active. We're gonna give you something else there. We're talking about a specially curated piece of music CD that John's going to do, a little jazz. And I guess I'm warning you now, he told you it's going to have some country on it, too. It's going to be all for real.
Yes.
Next week on Wade's World, we've got an amazing guest. We've got Becky Bond. She and Zach Exley, who is one of the organizing founders of MoveOn.org, are going to be my guests, talking about their experience on the Sanders campaign and some amazing things they've done with volunteers. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. We say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Thanks to John Kane. Next week we'll have Becky Bond as our guest. This is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Away we go.